Hello, and welcome to another one of our Baird Bites. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Wilbur Liebman, a longtime friend of Baird. Many of you will have met Wilbur, you know, at our various CITES meetings over the last couple of years. President Obama appointed Wilbur to be chair of the National Labour Relations Board back in 2009. For those of you who don't know, the National Labour Relations Board in the US basically oversees the US system of labor relations. Wilbur was first appointed to the NLRB by President Clinton and was twice reappointed by President Bush. She's the third longest serving member of the NLRB in its 85-year history, stretching back to the time of the Roosevelt New Deal. Earlier, Wilbur served as Deputy Director of the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, but before that, she had a career as a labor lawyer working with the trade union movement, both with the International Union of Bricklayers and Allied Craftsmen. And by the way, the American unions are the only ones who call themselves international because they have a few members up in Canada, right? And also with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. She holds degrees from Barnard College and from George Washington University Law School. Since leaving the NLRB, Wilma has been engaged in various consultancy and advisory activities, mostly on the labor relations side of the fence. And most recently, she was appointed Chief External Ethics Officer for the United Automobile Workers Union. Yeah, and I think after some of the recent developments in the United Auto Workers, they needed some ethics. But anyway, Wilma has written extensively on labor relations issues since she left the board. Some of her writings have been for Baird, and you can see some references to them on the Baird website. So, Wilma, welcome. Now, I was going to start by asking you about your views on the growth of inequality and so on in the United States, but literally about 15 minutes before we started this, I saw a tweet by President Trump suggesting that the November election should be postponed. I couldn't let this go without asking you what your views on that are.
Well, thank you, Tom, first of all, for the opportunity to be here with you and have this discussion. I guess President Trump's tweet is not unexpected. For a while, he's been suggesting that he might not accept the results of a November election if he were to lose, that he view it as rigged. The polls show him increasingly disfavored compared to Joe Biden, the Democratic nominee, presumptive nominee. And so I would say this tweet is probably a symptom of some desperation. But one of the great fears, of course, about going into the election season is, first of all, what will happen in November. Because of the increase in the number of mail-in ballots, it may be a while before there are results. It may not happen that night, the election night, assuming the election goes ahead. And my own perspective is I hope that Joe Biden wins, and I hope he wins very decisively so that it would be hard to claim a rigged election. But there are still great unknowns as to whether the president and his supporters will accept the results. And come January, when there is the inauguration of the new president, whether he will respect the transition, assuming that Joe Biden wins the election. So there are a lot of fears and unknowns going forward.
I never thought I'd hear myself asking this question, but do you have fears for American democracy?
Absolutely. I think we are in a period that's been called a specter of illiberalism, where faith in our democratic institutions are very shaky. And you look at the whole panoply, the elections, the transition after elections, the judiciary, the press, participation in voting and elections. It's a very frightening time, I think, about American democracy. And there are huge gaps, and this will lead a little bit into your question about inequality, but I think this period represents a time where the gaps between the promise of democracy and the promise of the American dream and the reality of the lives of so many people, the grim realities of life for so many people, and the fears about democracy are very great. There is this gap.
The American dream after the Second World War was always that the next generation will be better off than this generation, that my children will be better off than me. Has that promise of the American dream been broken?
The data would absolutely confirm that it has been broken, that the mobility that was a part of this American dream with children doing better than their parents, that has really slowed enormously. And people are very afraid that their children will not do as well as they. And this pandemic, I think, is only increasing that fear.
What explains it? What explains this breaking of the American dream in your view?
Well, for about almost the last 40 years, what we have seen is wage stagnation, growing inequality, both wealth and income, the decline of the labor movement, and the decline and disintegration, really, of workers' bargaining power, the inadequacies of our social safety net to take care of things like healthcare, family leave, childcare, all those kinds of basic needs that are not addressed in our society. So there's been a slow disintegration of what we came to accept as the American social compact, or the compact between what we owe each other as citizens in a democracy.
What explains, in your view, Wilma, and I know you're coming from a democratic perspective, but what explains, in your view, this disintegration of the American social compact? Why has America gone the way it's gone?
Well, at some point, I guess, starting in the late 70s, we seem to move from what was considered a relatively regulated and controlled kind of democratic capitalism to one where finance took over. It became a world of financialization or financial capitalism with great pressure on corporations to achieve profits and to benefit their shareholders at the expense of workers and the communities in general. And this enormous pressure on companies to do that led to what has been called in our country the fissured workplace. We don't need to use that term. It's the notion of putting pressure on companies to focus on what was their core business and to outsource or contract with other companies to provide support services. So it started maybe with outsourcing internal kind of HR functions or certain kind of non-core functions to the business. But it more generally has led to outsourcing both domestic and global. Now the increasing use of online platforms as another form of outsourcing. And this has put pressure at the firms at the bottom end of the supply chains, a lot of market competition, so that wages have declined. So work that was once done, let's say, by Ford Motor Company. Ford Motor was the classic kind of vertically integrated corporation that did all of its functions, and then they began to contract out functions. And as they would contract out functions, including, let's say, their internal cafeteria, that the wages paid to the workers little by little declined. So there's no longer this kind of fairness in the economy that we saw at an earlier age.
But That I understand, Wilma. I'll come back to some of those issues about the fissured workplace and the gig economy and so on in a few moments. But why, in your view, did American voters vote for politicians who facilitated this?
Well, I think some of it was, has been called voting against economic self-interest because of cultural issues and social issues. Voting on questions like guns, abortion rights. So increasingly, it would seem to someone like me that working class people began to feel left behind economically and turn this into votes against, again, what I would put their economic self-interest, because of cultural issues. So the divides between cities and rural America, the suspicion of the so-called elites on the two coasts, the suspicion of intellectuals and the intellectual elite, frankly, the suspicion about science and all kinds of existing institutions, and that to some extent even extended to labor unions and the Congress itself and the government itself. So a growing anti-government kind of ideology seemed to take over, I would say, fueled by big right-wing money.
What about, I mean, the issue of globalization? I mean, to a great extent, the re-involvement of China in the global market economy back in the early 1990s, you know, suddenly opened up this huge new workshop of the world. And, you know, many, many American companies outsourced production that might otherwise have been done in the US to that. And let's be clear about this, let's be blunt about this. I mean, this was a consensus across the American political establishment. Democrats and Republicans all went down the globalization road. And President Trump, in his election campaign in 2016, appeared to ride a wave of anti-globalization. Let's bring American jobs back to America. Yeah, and we're all familiar with the infamous video of the closure of the carrier plant in Indiana. So would a President Biden lean towards that sort of re-onshoring, call it what you will, bring American jobs back to America? Because that's in a way what the American labor unions want, isn't it?
Yeah, but before I get to what Biden might do about that, let me just say, I think you raise very good points that I just want to emphasize, that I think the election of Donald Trump really exposed obvious discontent and a backlash against technological change and globalization, the sense that millions and millions of manufacturing jobs were lost in the United States, particularly in the so-called Rust Belt, and they went to China or elsewhere in Asia. And a strong backlash against those trends. So Trump clearly tapped into that existing resentment and discontent. The fact that he hasn't delivered for the people that voted for him because of those reasons is a fact that I'm not sure how many of his base actually recognize. I mean, he's done well for the top 1% in terms of tax cuts for the top and the privileged. But again, I think a lot of his base thinks that he talks like them and that he taps into something that they feel. What Biden will do in terms of bringing jobs back, I think, is unclear. I think the pandemic has revealed problems about the supply chain being so far away. The unavailability of some of these protective equipment, relying on China for masks and ventilators and things like that, certainly something that has been brought home. Whether even if manufacturing comes back to the U.S., it will result in more jobs is a big open question, of course, because of technology. So technology now can accomplish work with fewer actual jobs. So I think it's an open question. I think certainly Biden will be very aware of the problems that led to the election of Donald Trump and the discontent.
I sort of agree with you that if manufacturing does come back, whether it's to Europe, and I saw this morning about President Macron of France wanting to bring back pharmaceutical manufacturing to France, but I think it's going to be highly automated and it'll result in fewer jobs, but that may not necessarily be the issue. You mentioned the fractured workplace, eh? And it's fractured, I think, from your perspective in many ways. And one of the things I know you have been concerned about is the issues that the gig economy throws up. And the sort of what some commentators would call the false classification of gig workers as self-employed, when in fact they in reality may not be self-employed and may be sort of hidden employees. How do you see all of that?
Well, there's a lot of hype about the gig economy and the opportunities it may offer workers to work flexibly when they want, where they want, et cetera. It is certainly true that the gig economy, like technology or technological disruption more broadly, do bring opportunity and do bring flexibility. On the other hand, for many workers in the gig economy, I think anxiety may be the true reality of working in the gig economy rather than the freedom offered of flexibility. The reliance on this independent contractor or self-employed model increasingly is more precarious for workers. And this precarity has increased scrutiny of this business model and the insecurities of its flexible work arrangements. It often results in people making little money, oftentimes below the minimum wage. Sometimes people don't get paid and they have no real recourse. There's no appeal rights. There's no way to resolve disputes. Sometimes they get kicked off the platforms again without any recourse. It also results in people working on their own, anonymously in many cases, particularly the people that work on the online crowd work platforms, not actually in the physical work, in the physical world, like an Uber driver. And just this morning, I read an article, just came out, about the people who, as a result of the pandemic and the loss of either their jobs or their small businesses, are turning to what the article termed now the hustle economy. And these are people working on platforms I'd never heard the names of, called Patreon, Twitch, OnlyFans, Teachable. These are people who are offering their goods or their services, like they're devising online courses that people can take or exercise classes or something like that. And while it's helping people out during this pandemic, I guess it raises the same questions in the long run that the gig economy is really posing. Questions on in a longer frame in terms of whether the gig economy is increasing inequality worldwide, whether it's addressing inequality in some developing countries by giving opportunities for people to work. But it seems quite clear that it has the potential to erode good jobs, to erode labor standards, to shift power more to the owners of capital rather than to workers, and to leave workers without any legal rights under labor statutes. without any protections against discrimination or the right to act collectively to try to bargain towards better conditions. So it raises the fears of creating or exacerbating divides between society, the inequalities in society. The flexibility that it offers, there's no reason why it can't offer flexibility and still treat people as employees in the legal sense.
I was just going to say to you, hasn't it always been the argument of what I would call the labor movement in its broadest sense, that all new technologies, you know, undermine existing labor rights? Now, I'm not this old, but I do remember reading about labor riots, about the spinning jenny and the invention of new technologies in the cotton industry, and, you know, what was the roots of the Industrial Revolution. And yet, at the end of the day, that Industrial Revolution ended up making the working class one hell of a lot better off than they previously were. So is it a question of trying to find a way of, how do we put it, bringing this technology within a framework of rights rather than rejecting this technology? Because you can't uninvent technology. Once it's invented, it's invented, right? And so how do you see the way forward for the gig economy?
I think you make a great point that you can't uninvent technology, and technology doubtless offers many opportunities to make work and lives better. It may eliminate a lot of the drudgery of certain kinds of jobs and eliminate really tough, menial type of work. But the problem is that the law has always been slow to catch up with technological change and other kinds of changes. And so all of these new technologies and new inventions create new dangers to society, new dangers to liberty. And the law always drags. And I think what's going on now is that the gig economy has put a spotlight really on the fact that the laws that we exist in the United States are industrial era jobs and haven't kept up with a tremendous transformation in society and the economy and technology. And any attempts to change the labor law, in particular over the last 85 years of all, ended in legislative gridlock. But what the gig economy has done is to show that this model doesn't work for too many people. So the definitions of who's an employee covered by the labor laws and who's an independent contractor excluded are failing people, like excluding far too many people. So what we see now are efforts to amend the laws. This is all going on at the state level, not at the federal level, but efforts to amend the laws so that gig workers would be included. Alternatively, to look at benefits that would be provided to these people, because when they work as independent contractors, they have no rights, protections, or benefits. We have a weak social safety net in the United States. So we need to look at models that would provide benefits to all workers, regardless of legal classification, and make these benefits portable for people as they move from job to job or contract to contract or gig to gig.
So let me ask you a question. If you are still the chair of the National Labor Relations Board, you know, and an issue came before you around the classification of Uber drivers, how would you think about that? What would your answer to that be? Are they workers? Are they self-employed? Are they?
Well, we don't.
Now, let me be clear. I know that's not exactly within the province of the National Labor Relations Board, but
It is.
Tell me about it then. Tell me about it.
And in fact, the Trump General Counsel of the National Labor Relations Board issued an advisory opinion few years ago that found that Uber drivers were independent contractors. But a case could easily come before the NLRB of some Uber drivers who were deactivated from the platform and claimed they were unlawfully fired for, let's say, engaging in collective activity or trying to form a union. That would come before the NLRB. We don't have the worker classification that exists, say, in Britain. So all we have is this binary classification under U.S. labor law of employee or independent contractor. And I have to say that looking at Uber drivers, it's pretty hard for me to conclude that they are really an independent business. It is true that they can go on the app when they want and not go on it pretty much when they don't want. So they have that freedom and flexibility. But when they are on the app, they are pretty tightly controlled by Uber. Uber sets the rates for the fares. Uber has algorithms that control them while they're on the app. They can be deactivated from the platform because of consumer ratings. In a way, Uber outsources the quality control and discipline to its customers. So there's a lot of control, which is really the test of employee status.
So in a sort of a way, what you're saying, Wilma, is technology to one side. It's a bit like the old days when you turned up on the docks in the morning and you turned up if you wanted to turn up. And if you got a job, you worked on the docks for the day. But when you were on the docks, you were under the control of the stevedores and the bosses. And this is just a technological version of that. Would I be right in drawing that analogy?
I think it's a great analogy. And it goes to the point I made a minute ago, which is, just because flexibility is offered in a business model does not mean people cannot have the rights, benefits, and protection of employee status under the law.
What I hear you saying is that you have the flexibility to turn up or not, but once you do turn up, you have no flexibility.
That's right. You're under the control of the employer.
So would you be tempted by the UK sort of classification of employees, self-employed, and somewhere in the middle, something that I myself have called independent workers? Yeah, would you be tempted by that third way approach?
You know, when I sat on the NLRB, I learned about that middle category, and I thought, you know, that has some interest because it would expand the numbers of people who could have certain benefits. So in Canada, for example, there's a dependent contractor classification that enables the people who are called dependent contractors to engage in collective bargaining. They don't have access to the full range of benefits and protections, but they have the right to engage in collective bargaining. This was particularly put in place in Canada with truck drivers in mind. And so I thought, oh, that's an interesting concept because it would expand the numbers of people who could engage in collective bargaining. With the gig economy, the notion of a third way or third category came back into the discussion. And I began to see at that point that, and by the way, it was the platforms at first that kind of promoted this notion, because some of the platforms said, we understand that in the United States, we have a weak social safety net. So if we had a third category, we could give people some benefits. We wouldn't have to treat them as employees for all purposes. They wouldn't have right to bargain collectively. We wouldn't have to pay them a minimum wage, but we could give them some benefits without them being called employers. And so I saw then that in this context, the idea of a third way wasn't a good idea, because it would be a way for employers to downgrade people who are today employees into this third category. And in the third category, or the intermediate category, they wouldn't have the full rights, protections, and benefits of an employee. So it might work counter to what I initially thought would be a way to expand access to rights and benefits. Instead, it would be a way to erode the protections that millions of people have.
Okay. Would you be tempted, for instance, by the initiative of the European Union at the moment, which would appear to be towards giving gig economy workers a clear and unambiguous right to organize and bargain collectively, whatever their status?
Yeah, I think that has some appeal. It is something that, at least before the COVID crisis hit, a few states were actually discussing. They were discussing making the definition of employee more rigorous, but also perhaps creating a collective bargaining waiver for those gig economy companies that would extend collective bargaining rights to their workers, that they might be excused from the rigid requirements of employee status that, that the law otherwise would require. These, I think these discussions in these states have kind of stalled because of the COVID crisis, but maybe one day would return. And what it taps into, of course, are antitrust law constraints on the ability of independent work, independent businesses or the self-employed to engage in collective action or collective bargaining. So these state laws would have to create antitrust law exemptions for this to happen.
Okay, listen, Wilma, I'm going to stop it there because we've sort of run out of our time. But I'm going to come back again and talk to you in another session about other issues. I'd like to talk to you about what you think, for instance, COVID-19 has done to the workplace and what the long-term impact of, you know, for instance, remote and working will be. And I'm interested in your comment about that third category of worker creating a sort of a trapdoor into which existing employees could fall into a sub. Yeah, I'll come back and talk to you about some of these things. But I'm also very, very interested in knowing what you think that a Biden presidency might bring to what I consider to be the very broken American labor relations systems as it exists today. So can I thank you for your time for the moment, and we'll talk again.
Okay, thank you.